Okay. So I'm here to talk about investments in children's health and the Kenya Cash Transfer for Orphans and Vulnerable Children. Myself and my co-authors have no conflicts of interest to disclose. So the motivation for this study is really that although we've seen under five mortality rates decline between 1990 and 2015, that the sub-Saharan African burden of under five mortality remains the largest among the world. And within that, infectious diseases such as pneumonia and malaria are leading causes of under five death. So I'm interested in specifically examining Kenya, which has a Human Development Index ranking of about 145 out of 187 countries. The impact of HIV has left an effect on life expectancy, has led to a lot of intersectionality between poverty and missing generation families, where we see a lot of children being orphaned, grandparents raising children, grandchildren. Meanwhile, malaria is estimated to cause about one in five under five deaths, and acute respiratory infections account for about 16% of all child mortality in Kenya. So the framework that my team and I really lend ourselves to using is the Mosley and Chen Child Survival Framework, where we understand child mortality and negative health outcomes as really stemming from an accumulation of adverse social, economic, biological, and environmental factors. And poverty really contributes to the inability to control for or counteract such factors. It leads to greater exposure, thereby increasing the likelihood that children are exposed to environmentally borne diseases such as malaria or pneumonia. And young and under five children living in poverty are the most vulnerable. So the questions that we're really interested in examining are whether Kenya's largest social protection, the cash transfer for orphans and vulnerable children, impacts children's health. And we do this by measuring disease outcomes, such as malaria and pneumonia. Our populations of interest are children, obviously under five, but children 0 to 7 years of age. Additionally, we're interested in examining whether CTOVC impacts health capital building behavior, such as health seeking in the event of illness. And this was defined as seeking care from an ideal health provider, such as a health facility, a doctor, a nurse, a community health worker. So why is this interesting, first of all? Well, cash transfers are being implemented widely, globally. Actually, they're a very popular policy instrument right now. It's because you can flexibly tailor the program to achieve a number of programmatic objectives, social economic objectives as well. Within sub-Saharan Africa, as of 2012, it was estimated that 123 cash transfer programs were implemented. Most of these programs are dedicated towards alleviating poverty, building human capital, trying to counteract the negative effects that persistent poverty have upon human capital investment. And so an attribute of a lot of sub-Saharan African social cash transfer programs is that they give money to qualifying households unconditionally. That is, once the household meets a set of conditions, they don't have to do anything more, they don't have to meet any additional requirements in order to receive the cash. So the Kenya cash transfer program in particular, it accepted, it qualified households based on the presence of one OVC under the years of 18 years old who has at least one deceased parent or who is chronically ill or whose main caretaker is ill. And the second qualification is being ultra poor, which means that the family is in the lowest income decile in Kenya. There was a two-step verification process in order to be enrolled in the program. The first was that community health workers would go into the communities, identify the qualifying households based on the characteristics that I've described, having the presence of an OVC, being ultra-poor, and then they would invite the households to apply into the program. From there, the district would receive the applications, and they would verify whether the household was actually eligible for the program. The main note about this is that there's no self-selection into the program because households cannot seek it out on their own. Really, a community worker has to come in and identify the household. Because of the unconditional nature of the program, take-up was near universal. Okay. So the study design is a cluster randomized longitudinal study. Basically, the program was implemented in 2007. A baseline was collected, obviously, before the program began, and the follow-up was collected in 2009. 28 clusters were included for in this study. So among seven districts, you had four locations, which is the fourth geographical or administrative unit, within each district, two locations were randomized to treatment and two were randomized to control. We have about an urban to rural household ratio of 1-4, and as you can see, treatment to control household ratio of 2-1. So even though you probably can't really see this, I wanted to show you the baseline analysis to demonstrate that randomization was relatively successful. Basically, we see some differences between the demographic characteristics of treatment groups, but notably, no differences in welfare status between the households. And so something to point out, heads of household characteristics differed between treatment and control, where the treatment group was more likely to have older, less educated female heads of households than the control group. There were some differences between control variables that are that impact our outcomes. For instance, the treatment group was less likely to own a mosquito net, but the control group was more likely to source their water from an unprotected or natural source, which is less ideal than a protected source. Okay, this is just to show that there are some differences in investment behavior, but nothing that would warrant significant attention. So I guess nothing substantially different. There are some differences between distance to a doctor, where the treatment group is more likely to be farther away from a doctor than the control group, but there's no difference when we look at distance to malaria treatment, for instance. Okay, so my estimation strategy uses a generalized linear latent and mixed model, which is a lot to say, but it's the reason that I use this model is to allow for the clustering of observations at the household level and the location level. And the location level is particularly significant because it is the level of randomization where you might believe that there's some selection bias, but I mean, I don't believe so. And also the GLAM model allows us to examine to use a logistic link to examine these binary outcomes. And as I mentioned before, we're interested in upper respiratory illness and health seeking when ill. And there are a number of control variables that are all listed here. I'll let you read them yourself. What differs in the care-seeking model and between the care-seeking and fever model is that I have some medical expenditures, distance to malaria treatment as additional controls. Okay, so now we have our results. So we see that in the sample of children 0 to 7 years old, first I should note that all of these results are presented in odds ratios. Okay, so you probably need a calculator to do some of the, to figure out what the impacts are, but I'll tell you as well. So in the sample of children 0 to 7 years old, we see that the control group was more likely to be ill than the treatment group. They had an odds of 1.8 times more likely to be ill. We also see that there's a sex differential effect, whereby girls were more likely to be ill than boys, and they were 1.3 times more likely. We see no differences in between treatment groups in the under five sample, and in the health-seeking models, I detect no significant differences between treatment groups. Okay, so I was trying to figure out the results on the health seeking. And so I broadened the definition to include non-ideal providers. And I thought it was an interesting exercise because sometimes, you know, as researchers, we have like a specific definition of what constitutes like appropriate care. I expand this definition to include unconventional providers such as public dispensary, non-hospital or health facility, pharmacist or chemist, shop or market. And I find that there are still no differences between the treatment groups. But what was interesting was that the control group was more likely to define care seeking in these unconventional ways. Okay, so in conclusion, we see reductions in children's illness for older children. We see no differences for younger children. This is significant. The reductions in children's illness, even for older children, is significant because, remember, there are no conditions on these households. So once they receive the cash sum for participating in the program, we're really seeing what they do with their money and how they invest it, naturally unconstrained, without monitoring, without any enforcement of how that money is used. We did see a differential effect where boys are less likely to be ill. We see no evidence of orphan differential effects, so there's no orphan discrimination. And finally, we see no differences in health-seeking behavior between treatment groups. I also run some further analysis in order to identify the causal mechanisms, and that's probably the next step for this study. But I see no differences in mosquito net acquisition. I don't identify cook fuel usage as the reason why. I hypothesize, so part of my other research team, they conducted a study examining these households spent their money on, and specifically they're examining food expenditures, and they found that food expenditures among the treatment group significantly increased, and families were purchasing more cereal, meats, and dairy. So I hypothesized that these effects might be driven by changes in nutrition and investment in food. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. So we've seen five very good examples of international health programs and policies. We've seen how financing of child health services and impact of aid can make a difference. We've seen how Dr. Kinkasa showed how by using information you can improve a TB program by minimizing the bad things and improving the primary health care of these patients. And Mr. Okia showed us the importance of monitoring resistance, insecticide resistance, and how to inform our spraying programs. Jan showed us how to put fistula on the map and how to use that information to improve access to health services. And lastly, but not the least, Caroline showed us the importance of looking at the effectiveness of the interventions that we use and see how they impact the child health status. So I think you have lots of questions, so please raise your hand, introduce yourself, and ask questions. Please don't make presentations and speeches, just questions. Thank you. Well, we have the first question. I have a question. Carolyn, how much was the cash transfer that was given to the families? And do they still continue the cash transfers? And how was the findings? Did that impact anything that they've done?
Yeah, so...
would you mind coming to the microphone so it can be recorded?
Sure.
Sorry, thank you. For making you walk.
Yes, that is a great question. So actually, the cash transfer is about 20% of the household's total monthly expenditure. So that's a substantial amount. You know, in U.S. dollars, 2011, it was like $21. But, I mean, the fact that 20% you'll see changes in expenditures. The cash transfer program is still ongoing. You know, they try to graduate children who are over 18. However, there are still about, you know, it's predicted that over 240,000 1,000 households have been served by this program today. And so these promising results have really led to a lot of support, and I think really the government of Kenya has undertaken this program as well. And so it's their largest.
Great.
Yeah.
We have a question.
Yeah.
So do you mean as like a follow-up or even at the beginning?
Yeah, I think it would be included in your, you know, the hardest to reach people, right, are often the ones that are unfortunately excluded from programs for various reasons. So I guess my question is were there any shortfalls of the program?
I think, you know, that's something that we haven't really examined in detail, but when we did go and conduct a second follow-up in 2011, we found that sometimes the program wasn't implemented in its full intention. You know, the design should be that cash is received regularly, like, you know, every 1 to 2 months, but we found that some people had problems accessing their cash. But as for, like, community composition and identifying the most marginalized households, the theory is that if you have people who know the community very well, they ought to be able to identify the greatest need households. And so, while I can't really give you a quantification of, you know, how that worked out, I think that helps offset your concerns. But good question. Thank you.
Great.